Hey, everyone. If you like this podcast, you should check out the full finance journey at realvision.com/RVpod to get the full view of what Real Vision is all about. A video on demand platform you can watch anywhere. Our members get daily videos and analysis, plus access to more than 3,000 videos for beginners and experienced investors alike, and live events online. You'll join the most thoughtful community in finance. More than 300,000 people who trust Real Vision to be the anchor to truth in the financial world. To get started, visit realvision.com/RVpod. Use the promo code PODCAST10 to get 10% off our essential membership for your first year. Enjoy the show.
Good afternoon, folks, and welcome to the Real Vision Daily Briefing. I'm Andreas Steno, and quite tellingly, I'm sending live amidst a very severe thunderstorm here in Copenhagen, Denmark today. It's been another interesting day in the world of macro, not least as we've had an official sovereign debt default, basically. It is today the 27th of June, and I am very happy to be joined by an old friend of the show, Peter Bukwa, the CIO of Bleakley Advisory Group. How are you today, Peter?
Good, Andreas. Thanks for having me on again.
Of course. Basically, few are better at assessing bond markets than you, Peter. Russia defaulted on a few international debt obligations today. In my opinion, probably more of a technical default than anything else, but please unpack this situation a bit for our audience. Should we care about this debt default of Russia?
I agree that it's technical in that it was not by their choice. It was, of course, forced upon them. Certainly, they have the capability of paying back these bonds, but were not allowed to. If anything, it's the bondholders that are getting screwed. Russia is saying, well, we have the money, and if you don't want our money, then we'll just keep our money. So I look at this as a very idiosyncratic situation. I would not extrapolate this to broader emerging markets or country ability to pay. And as you said, it's more technical than anything else.
Yeah, I tend to agree. It's been an ongoing debate for a couple of weeks in a row now, whether the Russian economy is doing better or worse than before the invasion of Ukraine. And one of the things that have been debated quite a lot is the level of the Russian ruble, because it looks really strong on charts if you chart it against the US dollar, for example. Do you consider the strength of the Russian ruble on the charts as a sign of strength in the Russian economy?
I think it just reflects the flows. The oil money that continues to come in. The huge current account surplus that they have, as their exports obviously go up pretty strongly, and their imports have essentially collapsed. I mean, the economy itself is in a really tough situation. We don't hear about the thousands and thousands, the tens of thousands, the hundreds of thousands of people that have lost their jobs, with a lot of Western companies closing down. Now, some will reopen under a sort of a Russian umbrella, but plenty have lost their jobs. They are losing access to a lot of technology, whether it's technology at the oil pump from Halliburton or Schlumberger, or Western technology in a variety of other areas. So they're hurting. But again, it's all about the flows that they're benefiting from, and whether that's also only accepting rubles for payment for oil, or having capital controls within their country, all adding up to this strength. But again, it's certainly not reflective of a robust Russian economy. It just reflects the still heavy revenue that's piling in, specifically with energy at these very high prices, and their ability to still sell, even though the customer mix is obviously different.
Yeah. But Peter, who are the winners and losers of this current situation with Russia? I know we have a chart that we can bring up on the export destinations of Russian exports. We have Germany, Italy, big countries within the Eurozone high on that list. So who would you claim to be the winners and losers of the current situation?
Well, Putin is clearly a winner because he's still able to finance his military machine through the exports of oil and gas in particular. Obviously, agriculture as well, but for purposes of this conversation, dollar-wise, it's going to be predominantly oil and gas. So he's able to continue on as is in terms of revenue. I wouldn't say the Russian people, because it's not like he's using that money to filter down to the Russian people. The Russian people instead, as we mentioned, dealing with a very difficult economy. Now, from an inflation standpoint, the strength of the ruble is helping to mitigate their jump in the cost of living. But we're at a point where even the Bank of Russia is now worried about the ruble being too strong, and they're doing what they can to actually weaken it. Now, other countries that are able to buy Russian barrels at a discount, like India, like China, they're also a beneficiary. I'm not sure what the exact dollar amount is right now, but I know it's a $15 to $20 discount that these countries were able to procure Russian barrels with. We know who's hurting, of course, is European countries that are now getting clipped by the reduction in gas deliveries, where Putin's sort of playing a game with them. That's not helping them. And we'll see to what extent this gain on the part of Putin actually starts to hurt him, because he's losing more customers. And like I said earlier, he's losing the technology to continue on producing at the rate at which he was. And they're not producing as much because their wells are not as productive as they once were. And over time, that will hurt them. But at least for now, he's able to get away with it.
Speaking of commodities, I actually think that we've seen some interesting price actions in many commodity markets over the past 2-3 weeks here. We've seen a retracement in a few of the very important industrial metals. We've also seen a material retracement lower in the price of natural gas in the US, for example. So what do you make of this recent repricing lower in commodity markets?
I mean, it's clearly in response to global growth concerns, with the R word, recession word, on everybody's mind, and what that potentially is going to do to the demand side of the supply-demand curve with respect to commodities. It's also in the context of a very sharp run-up that we saw, where everyone was bullish, and we got certainly offsides in terms of that sentiment. So the question is to what extent do we get demand destruction going into this downturn? How elastic or inelastic is the demand for commodities? And of course, we can break it down amongst the groups. The demand for food is not necessarily going to falter. But if you look within the commodity space, if you're going to play it as an investor, and we had sold our fertilizers, but demand destruction for fertilizers has certainly taken place. And we've gotten some better delivery yields out of Brazil and Argentina. But if farmers are going to plant less fertilizer this summer, it means that maybe the harvest come October may not be that as robust. Industrial metals, which are probably the most cyclical and the most elastic of the commodity space, well, that's certainly gotten hurt, particularly copper. I think energy is certainly much more inelastic. That people still have to get into their cars to drive to work and see friends, and you still need to heat your house and cool it during the summer. So that will likely remain more sticky in terms of the demand side. But from a market perspective, like I said, it got overheated. Now everyone's talking recession. So what do? You sell economically sensitive things, and certain commodities certainly fit that bill.
If you listen to Jay Powell at the latest Federal Reserve meeting, it almost sounded as if he started targeting the price at the pump as the main inflation target for the Federal Reserve, at least indirectly via the channel of inflation expectations. Do you think it will matter for the Federal Reserve outlook if we get a further slide in commodity prices?
I think it will matter in where the Fed funds rate ends up. And we've certainly seen that repricing in the Fed funds futures, where at the peak, we were pricing in a 4% sort of called terminal rate which people like to use that term, in the middle of next year. And now we're just under, we're probably closer to 3.3, 3.4, which actually is where the Fed thinks that they can take the Fed funds rate this year alone. So I do think that, and just as we've seen with the mentality of the Fed, is that they obviously went extreme on one end. They seem very intent on going extreme the other end. So they're going to raise 75 in July. So this decline in the commodity prices, to your actual question, will help determine whether they go 50 or 75 in September. But I think that they've lost so much credibility in how they played this inflation game, where they, of course, had their chips all in on transitory, that they're going to take the opinion of, they're more focused on getting the Fed funds rate to a certain level, which then they can take a step back and play it by ear from there. And if the inflation numbers start to come in, well, good, they feel like they did their job. If the inflation numbers come in rather sharply and we go into a deep recession, well, at least they then have rates to cut. And I think around 3% is that number. And granted, the dot plot got to 3.4 in their last meeting, but I think they're intent on doing 75 in July, which will get you to about 2.5, which is where the Fed funds rate topped out in the fourth quarter of 2018. And I think they'll probably go 50 in September, depending on the data, which would get them to that 3%. And then from there, it's completely play up by ear. But I think the Fed's credibility in their eyes will be lost if they start having buckling of the knees, just because oil prices went from 120 to 100. You know, that's not enough for them to pivot, because they know if they lose any credibility that they're trying to regain, well, then the markets are going to play around with them. And maybe you see a big sharpened fall in the dollar and a spike in commodity prices. And then they look like complete idiots. So I think, again, the level of Fed funds rate, while they say we're going to do what we can to bring down inflation, I think they're very focused on getting to 3, because that they believe will give them flexibility to go either way from there. And one last point on this, I wouldn't be surprised if they ended at 2.5, if history is any guide, because we know the last 40 years, each hiking cycle ended below the previous hiking peak.
We're going to take a quick break and be right back with more of the day's top analysis on the Real Vision Daily Briefing.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called PIE, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know.
Trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to podcasts on.
Yeah, podcast, homecast.
Your podcasting apparatus. Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
Yeah, that's a very fair point. I've also noted how the correlation between the gasoline price and then the euro dollar futures in the first quarter of 2023 are very correlated. And it goes right to your point that for the terminal rate, for the ultimate expectation for the federal funds rate level, we should probably watch the development in the commodity space, but not for the very near-term outlook. I know, Peter, that you want to discuss another central bank also this afternoon, because you have a great point in terms of what's going on in Japan. A lot of people are watching the development in the 10-year space and the yield curve. But there is actually maybe an even more interesting development going on further out the curve in Japan. We can bring a chart up on the development in the 40-year point on the yield curve. Please unpack your thinking on Bank of Japan and why this 40-year point is so important to watch.
So as you mentioned, we know that the BOJ has essentially fixed the yield curve out to 10 years, with that 10-year trading within a band of minus 25 basis points, plus 25, and we keep bumping up against the upper end of that. The reason why I like to look at the 40-year is because it's the furthest away from BOJ manipulation of not just 25 basis points at the 10-year, but a negative 10 basis points on the deposit, or called overnight rate. So going out 40 years, it's the most market-driven part of the JGB yield curve. Therefore, if you want to look for signals, if there's any signaling left in the JGB market, there's some there. The 40 years is where to go. And overnight, the yield got close to 140, which is a fresh 6.5-year high. So it's, when I see that, it just tells me that it's getting tougher and tougher for the BOJ to be sitting on that 10-year beach ball underwater, and that it's just inevitable that ball is going to spurt higher. Now, the BOJ, I think, will widen that band. I have no idea when, but I think they'll have no choice. But they're going to do it, what most likely will be, in thin increments of maybe 10 basis points just to start, as a way to cap the weakness in the yen. Because just from a signaling standpoint, if they went from 25 to 35, economically, it really wouldn't matter that much. It's 10 basis points. Signaling, though, it could lead to a rally in the yen, which I think at some point they're going to want. Because at the same time as Kuroda is sitting on yields because he wants to generate his 2% inflation sustainably, and he's already done that for two straight months, I think that there's a lot of pressure within the Ministry of Finance that they don't want any more weakness in the yen. Maybe they don't get it if oil prices stop going up, because over the past couple of years, there has been some relationship FX-wise with the yen and energy prices, because we know they import so much energy. So you can draw a chart up until the past month that crude oil and the yen have pretty much moved in lockstep. It's broken down a bit of late, with oil prices pulling back and the yen really not at around 135. But I would really, again, look at that 40-year yield every day as the real part of the yield curve that is sort of speaking out with its own voice and not being fully manipulated by the BOJ.
And in that regards, we should remember that I think there are two countries that are extremely reliant on foreign energy sources, one being Germany, the second being Japan. And that could be the reason why we have this correlation between the oil price and the dollar-yen FX cross. We talked initially about the market slowly but surely reacting to the growth scare that is potentially upcoming. And today we got news out of the US related to the durable goods orders. Of course, one of the gauges that one could look for when assessing the outlook for the US economy. What do you make of the positive surprise on the headline for the durable goods orders?
So yes, it came up 7/10 the headline. I think 1/10 was expected, and also the core durable goods order, they call X-ing out. It's basically non-defense capital goods ex aircraft. Mm-hmm. That also slightly beat. Also, the prior month was revised upward. So in response, the Atlanta Fed actually raised their second quarter GDP estimate by 0.3, from 0 to plus 0.3. But these numbers are reported in nominal terms. So even with the upside surprise, in real terms, and yes, the Atlanta Fed is in real terms, but they don't necessarily quickly adjust on the inflation side as quickly as they do on the nominal side. So if you look at May, in the May PPI number, I'm just doing a back of the envelope, this is nothing scientific here, May goods prices in PPI, putting aside services, was up 1.4% month over month. Headline durable goods orders were up 7/10. So you can argue that, yes, in nominal terms, durable goods orders went up, but in real terms, they're still falling. And I think when you break down the GDP equation and trying to figure out, are we in a recession? Are we about to go into recession? Obviously, the biggest chunk is consumer spending. And on in real terms, we can argue that that is on the cusp of breaking down. And then you have gross private investment, which some of that is commercial real estate, residential real estate, but the other component is capital spending. And are we on the cusp of a downturn in real terms in capital spending? Now, durable goods orders, keep in mind, does not include software spending. Software spending is still going to remain pretty healthy, but mostly bigger companies. And when you think about investment, investment comes from savings, or theoretically it does. It comes from company cash flow. And if we're going into a growth slowdown and companies have less cash flow, well, then just by default, they're going to be investing less in their business because there's less cash to go around. So that is another component which is potentially going to reflect a downturn in the economy. And then you have trade, which the global economy is slowing down. So terms of trade is going to slow. And then you have government spending, which is typically a plus sign. But you know, this is sort of how you should break down the debate about whether we're going into recession or not. So that's why the durable goods numbers, I think, was important about how companies are going to respond from here. Now, Google, Microsoft, the big companies, you know, they'll maintain a certain level of CapEx because, you know, they have the cash flows to do it. But not everyone does in the large company space, and certainly not for the small and middle-sized companies in an economic slowdown.
In relation to this debate on whether we are about to enter a recession or not, I wanted to play a clip for you from an interview that aired earlier today on the Real Vision platform between discussion between Francis Gannon and Maggie Lake on the small pockets that are still performing within the U.S. economy. So let's have a listen and get back to the discussion on the U.S. economy.
I think people in general are looking for a big crescendo. They're wanting this moment that, you know, everything screams, this is the bottom. I think this is an environment where you're not going to get that. And the bottom might take a couple of months to actually, you know, happen. And so second quarter earnings reporting period are going to be increasingly more important. I would tell you that, you know, when I look at the economy and the slowing economy, the economy is still working. It's still open. There's still pockets of strength. And I think people forget that you have regional, you know, pluses and minuses typically in the United States, just given the size of our overall economy, but it's still open and working. It might not be perfect here today. It might not be growing, you know, 2% plus. It might be 1%. It might be zero, wherever it might be, but it's still open. And I think that's something to remind ourselves.
You can watch the entire interview if you are an Essential Plus or Pro subscriber on the Real Vision platform. But back to the points of the interview, Peter, are there still pockets of the U.S. economy performing above trend or about trend?
Well, to his point, the U.S. economy mostly grows. You need labor force increase and productivity, and you're going to get GDP growth. But you have cyclical downturns that are called recessions. Just as night follows day, you have recessions that follow expansions. Obviously, expansions run a lot longer, thankfully, than the recessions, but we're still going to get up and many of us go to work and live our lives. Obviously, it'll be different somewhat in a recession, but we still sort of chug along and work through it, even though it still is painful in that downturn. The question of what works in a recession, well, some things work, but relatively speaking, if I'm Kellogg's and I'm selling snacks and cereals, and for full disclosure, we own it in an income strategy that we have, people are still going to eat breakfast and they're going to still eat Pop-Tarts as a snack, but they may eat less or they may trade down. And you may go to the supermarket and you may get store brand cornflakes instead of Kellogg's cornflakes. You're still buying a box of cereal, but you're changing your spending behavior. And also, we also have to understand of what context is this recession occurring at from a market perspective. It's occurring with valuations that even after this pullback are still very high, are still expecting optimistic earnings growth. And I say optimistic earnings growth because If you look at consensus estimates on Bloomberg, for example, which is my data feed, the analysts are still expecting about $228 a share in earnings. And I find that sort of in la-la land of an earnings estimate. So we have credit spreads that even though they've widened, junk bond yields have doubled. Historically speaking, going into recession, they're still relatively low in yield and tight in spread. So it's that market backdrop in which this economic slowdown is entering in. Now, if valuations were low, if the S&P 500 was trading at 13 times earnings and credit spreads were much wider, I would say, yeah, we're entering in a recession. That's going to hurt. But markets may be able to absorb that to an extent. Now, we know that we do have bear markets coinciding with economic downturns, so that always happens. But it's to me, it's just too nonchalant to say, yeah, well, life goes on and the economy is still going to move on. It's not going to close down, therefore have no problem buying stocks. You know, we know in bull markets, valuations expand, and that's why stocks go up much faster than EPS and GDP growth. And on the downturn, stocks usually fall more than the economic downturn because multiples fall at the same time earnings fall. So stock prices are just sort of a leveraged view on earnings and the economy. And that's why you get moments in time when stocks grow a lot faster than GDP growth and they fall a lot faster than any decline in GDP growth.
We're going to take another quick break and be right back with more of the day's top analysis on the Real Vision Daily Briefing.
Have you ever experienced turbulence on a flight and wondered why?
And you can see all the terrain around you. You've got no issue with visibility or anything?
No, everything's peachy.
Maybe you've sat on the tarmac for hours wondering why your plane isn't moving.
Well, we're outside here. They're saying the ramp is closed. They won't let us park because of Air Force One.
Listen in on the conversations between pilots and air traffic controllers on the Air Traffic Out of Control podcast.
5-1-0, declaring an emergency. There's smoke in the cabin. I need to make a landing right now on 31 left.
We have the most interesting, wild, and funny ATC recordings you will ever hear. Check out Air Traffic Out of Control wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
If we look at the ISM manufacturing index, I'd say that there is usually a very strong directional correlation to the S&P 500 or NASDAQ, for that matter. We actually got a small regional print out of Dallas earlier today showing that the manufacturing sector of Texas is declining quite rapidly. What do you make of the cyclical manufacturing outlook if we look 1, 2, 3 quarters ahead and the repercussions for the equity markets?
So going into today's Dallas print, we had a minus sign in front of New York. We had a minus sign in front of Philly. We had a plus sign in front of Kansas City, but had fallen month over month. And the Dallas print was minus 17.7, which is the lowest level, I think, since April or May of 2020, when we were just coming out of the sharp shutdown. So we still have to see what the national number is on Friday, the ISM. Then we'll get Chicago's regional number on Thursday. But we are seeing likely a contraction in the manufacturing / goods side of the U.S. economy. But we know that's where the excess occurred over the last couple of years. Whether it was checks to people, it was the stay at home, work from home, let's spend on technology and laptops and a deck and a Peloton and this and that. We know that's where a lot of spending took place. And now it's hangover time. And that is being felt on the good side. That is being seen, like we said, in the manufacturing numbers. The question then is, what happens with the services side, since the services side is really the biggest part of the U.S. economy? And we're seeing at least a burst in travel and entertainment this summer, and we'll see how long that lasts. But I think it's safe to say that U.S. manufacturing, that the recession has begun. And the Dallas number, like I said, confirming New York and Philly. And now whether we see a minus 50, or I should say below 50 print on Friday, we'll have to see. The market PMI, which came out last week, still was above 50. barely, but you know, we're trending and getting close to that under 50 level.
If I look at my interest rate based models for the ISM manufacturing number 2-3 quarters ahead, I would basically not be too surprised to see a level below 45 fairly soon, and maybe even close to 40. We have a question from Ralph on the Real Vision side in relation to this discussion, because Ralph is interested in the developments within the mortgage-backed security space and whether it's linked to this slowdown in manufacturing. What do you make of the outlook for mortgage-backed securities and the link to the economy?
Well, I think the first link is the Fed no longer being a buyer and what implications that has for that market. Because we've seen certainly mortgage spreads, MBS spreads relative to treasuries widen out. Also, the worry that at some point, maybe sooner rather than later, that the Fed will actually have to start selling their holdings and mortgage-backed securities in order to meet their QT goals. Now, keep in mind, though, these are, you know, an agency MBS is still essentially government paper. So it's not like if you were the conventional bondholder, these aren't money good. It's just how they're being priced right now. How their spread is being priced relative to treasuries, which without this sort of big gorilla in the market no longer being there, and that's the Fed. So they created so much distortion and they were buying such a big chunk of that market that is definitely the huge influence. Now, economically speaking, we know there are a lot less mortgages being issued because of the downturn in housing. We know refis are down 75% year over year. Mortgage applications for purchases are down 10+%. We know that it is likely to continue to weaken. So, you know, that's the direct impact there on MBS.
I want to conclude the show with a question that relates to the initial debate we had on the Russian debt default. Bo asks us whether these sanctions are simply dangerous from a macro point of view, and whether these forced defaults, as we've seen in Russia today, could carry geopolitical repercussions over the next years?
I think that they're dangerous in many ways. It was dangerous in that while we're trying to punish Russia, the rest of us are getting hurt too by the rise in energy prices, the rise in food prices, and the pain that that we've had to deal with in response. I mean, Germany is dealing with pain because they're not getting the full flow of natural gas. Now, some of that is self-imposed because they decided to shut down the nuclear plants, but it's not costless to just throw sanctions on another country and assume that that country is the only one that gets hurt. We know we've done long-term damage potentially in the flow of funds by sanctioning the Bank of Russia and basically cutting off their access to about half of those reserves. What does that mean for the long-term implications of trade and energy? And whether it's going to be now done in euro, well, in yuan or in other currencies that are not euro-based or dollar-based. And what does that mean for the hegemony of the US and the dollar? And what happens when, let's just say tomorrow, Putin wakes up and says, what a stupid idea, I need to get out of Ukraine. Well, what do we do with these sanctions? Do we automatically take them off? Do they stay on? We don't know. So it's hard to make sanctions, like I said, laser focused on one enemy and think that's the only one that gets hurt. It's like scattering bombs, and some of them will hit the country it's intended for, but there's going to be a lot of collateral damage as well on the rest of us.
I always want to conclude the daily briefing with a meme that's a trademark of mine as a host. Today's meme relates to debate on sovereign debt. The final question I have for you, Peter, these sanctions imposed on Russia, basically pushing Russia towards China. Do you see a risk of the role of the dollar in the global economic ecosystem as a consequence of the sanctions?
Well, let's take the second largest holder of U.S. Treasuries, that being China. You can be sure that when Europe and the US put sanctions on the Bank of Russia, that the Chinese freaked out and said, oh my God, I have more than $1 trillion of these things. What happens if we wake up tomorrow and the US does it to us? So you can be sure that China is going to be continuing on the path of reducing their holdings of not just US treasuries, but possibly US assets. And other countries are going to do the same. And that means just wanting to own less US assets that are going to be potentially subject to the whim of the US government if they decide to punish another country. So while the US dollar will still be the main currency in which global transactions take place in, you can be sure when looking out over a longer-term time horizon, that percentage should go down over time.
Yeah, it is a bit worrisome. And when I speak on behalf of the generation of millennials, I can assure you that we are worried about this debt burden being placed on our shoulders over the next many decades. Peter, it was an absolute pleasure to talk to you again this afternoon. Thanks for joining.
Thanks, Andreas. Always fun to chat the world.
Likewise, I will be back tomorrow again with another great friend of the show, Tony Greer. Thanks for now, and thanks for watching the Real Vision Daily Briefing. Again, I'm Andreas Steno. See you tomorrow.
What's up, revolutionaries? Thanks for tuning in to the Real Vision Daily Briefing. For more content like this, head over to realvision.com and get unfiltered access to the very best, brightest, and biggest names in finance.